This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Asia Pacific currents.
News and labour issues from the Asia Pacific region.
We strongly condemn the police that arrest the protesters.
Saturday mornings at 9 o'clock.
On Community Radio 3CR.
Workers of the world should unite to fight this greedy capitalist.
Brought to you by Australia Asia Worker Link.
Good morning, good morning out there. And Gisela, did I steal your thunder?
You stole my thunder, so I'm just going to take it. Good morning. It's 1 minute past 9 o'clock here on Community Radio 3CR. You're tuned into Asia Pacific Currents. And thank you to the morning breakfast team who took us through to 9 o'clock this morning. I'm Giselle Hanna.
And I'm Pierre Morrow. And Asia Pacific Currents brought to you by Australia Asia Worker Links every week. And those phone numbers and web address, Giselle.
You can find us on the web, all the www.aawl.org.au. You can call us on 9663 7277, and you can email us at aawl@aawl.org.au.
And on this week's program, as usual, we've got a full roundup of stories from the region, and we're also a very special guest in the studio, Diana. Welcome back.
She's back. Morning, everyone.
He has been eagerly awaiting your return.
Let's hope the listeners have too.
I'm sure they have. Diana, one of our star component of this team and also our China specialist, has finally come back from China. And you'll be telling us all about what's happening in China in the second half of the program.
That's right.
And I'm going to turn off your mic for now and see if you can actually...
censorship.
No. All right. I can see I'm being outvoted here, so I shall leave it
on. Giselle wants the sound of my breathing broadcast all over Melbourne. Yes.
All right.
But time now. Time now for news around the region.
All right. And just very quickly, just to get the listeners up to date, as people would have heard, major protest and killings are happening in both Bahrain and Yemen in West Asia. And the interesting thing is that, I mean, Yemen's really got a long history of political upheaval, and there's been civil wars between left-wing forces. So, I mean, Yemen as a country has actually got some long historical working class origins and groups and organizations. So it'll be interesting how that develops. But Bahrain, we don't really know that much about it.
Well, we do know that a couple of weeks ago, particularly while things were pretty tense in Egypt and people weren't sure quite how that those uprisings were going to develop, that Bahrain actually had a meeting of all of the councils in power to, firstly, they were instructed to maintain the peace and hold and keep order. And obviously that wasn't possible as far as the powers are concerned with regard to people in Bahrain actually mobilising. And so the forces of the state did what the forces of the state do and literally open fired on people.
That's right. And the issue of Bahrain is also, of course, it's right on in the middle of the oil-producing countries. It's got a major military, US military base. And one thing that hasn't actually been talked about much, at least half the population is actually guest workers, migrant workers. So it'll be actually interesting to see how this develops with there's at least 500,000 of migrant workers there. So we'll certainly keep you informed. But we better move on, Giselle.
Sure. So our next story comes from Iraq, and consistent with what we were saying before, Pierre, spontaneous demonstrations demanding jobs, better services and respect for the constitution in cities across Iraq. Young unemployed Iraqis in Basra staged unplanned protests in front of the governor's offices on the 16th of February, calling on the local authorities to provide them with work opportunities. At the same time, another spontaneous demonstration took place in the centre of Sulaymaniyah. I'm sorry, I don't think I pronounced that correctly. Also calling for jobs and greater social protection. A man said to be a veteran Kurdish freedom fighter who fought against Saddam's defunct regime for years tried to set himself on fire to protest his poverty. whilst in the southern city of Kut in Wazit province, three people were killed as a result of clashes between security forces and protesters. And this is, you know, we talked about this on the program last night, and for anybody who's subscribed to Mini News, it really is clear that there is a pattern of people's uprisings across West Asia and North Africa, a region alternatively known as the Middle East.
That's right, Giselle. And again, it'll be interesting to see how in different countries it develops and which countries actually have a more developed working class movement. So we'll certainly keep people updated, as we said before. And going next door to Iran, where we've got slightly sad news about one of our comrades in jail, Mansour Osalu, who's been in jail since 2007, who is the president of the Vahed Syndicate Tehran Bus Workers Union, who was jailed in 2007 for organising a strike. And we've just heard news that he's actually been taken to hospital with chest pains. So we certainly wish Mansour Osalu all the best, and he's actually one of our featured comrades in jail to get free in our website.
And the online campaign for his release is still active. So Pierre mentioned the AAWL website, where we're supporting that campaign, but you can also go to Labour Start for more information on the campaign for his release. Moving over to Pakistan now, on the 7th of February, the Pilots Association started a strike, and soon all other workers, including cabin crew, kitchen staff and ground staff, joined in. The People's Unity CBA union issued the call for a complete strike. All other unions and associations joined in. A joint action committee of PIA employees was formed to lead the strike action. The staff has been on the picket line since Tuesday, and 100 flights, a significant difference, have been grounded. The Rangers paramilitaries have been deployed at Islamabad Airport, who, along with the airport security force officials, stopped the entry of protesting PIA workers into the airport premises on the orders of the Defence Minister. The workers have camped on the road in front of the Islamabad airport. The protesters were further enraged by the comments by the Defence Secretary calling the strike illegal. On Wednesday, ASF personnel baton-charged protesting PIA workers at the Jinnah International Airport, Karachi, injuring two women and several media persons present at the occasion.
We certainly wish our comrades in Pakistan all the best. And we actually know there's a few more labour struggles going there. But we did forget to say, Giselle, that we are planning next week to have a more in-depth analysis of Iran. So stay tuned for that. But that's our plan. Moving on to India, where we do have some good news that a national settlement was signed earlier this week in New Delhi, bringing significant wage improvements to 125,000 workers in the Indian cement industry. The workers will receive an increase of up to $75 per month. So that's a fantastic news. Not only that, the new agreement includes improved allowances for education of workers' children and for travel. So, well done.
And our next story is a part of an international campaign. This is the International Ban Asbestos Campaign, while the specific details come from India as well. In light of the overwhelming evidence that chrysotile asbestos is deadly and cannot be safely used, Indian trade unionists called on the Quebec government authorities in a meeting held on February 4 in the sidelines of Delhi's Sustainable Development Summit this year to act in an honourable manner by stopping serving the asbestos industry and put human health and human life ahead of political interests and financial profits. Highlighting the call for an end to the use of all forms of asbestos and asbestos-containing materials by international institutions, namely the World Health Organization, the International Labour Organization and 55 other countries worldwide are calling for a ban on the use of chrysotile asbestos. And trade unions argue that the Quebec government should not allow its land to be used for mining a potentially hazardous material. And also related to that story, over the last 6 months, public opposition has been growing in the eastern Indian state of Bihar over plans for a factory to manufacture asbestos products. Local residents took to the streets en masse on the 10th of February in the state capital, Patna, in a rally coinciding with the group Citizens Forum Against Asbestos, submitting a memorandum seeking the cancellation of the industrial licence given to the proposed factory. The campaign against a new factory is now pressuring the federal Indian government to officially impose a nationwide ban on the large-scale import of asbestos. The construction at the Balmukund Cement and Roofings factory has now been suspended.
I think that's if the unions can pressure the Indian government to stop the importation of asbestos, that'd be an amazing victory.
And let's hope that that is, people might know that there is a call for a general strike in India, and this may very well may be one of the demands of the general strike. Remember the last general strike in India won the Red Star Award.
That's right, for the number of people that...
100 million on the
right,
streets.
Has smashed any previous record by far. But just on the asbestos, I mean, it's great because the asbestos industry has actually targeted the whole region of Asia as a growing market because of the construction boom. So if it can be stopped in India, that'd be great.
And that international campaign is, again, one that is supported by AAWL, and you can get information about that from our website.
That's right. And just a last item, this from South Korea, where we've just had the news that the chairperson of the migrant trade union in South Korea has had their visa status cut or cancelled by the government very suddenly. This is not the first time that the leaders of the migrant trade unions in South Korea get their visa cancelled, and it's a way of the government to repress the legitimate concerns of migrant workers in South Korea by trying to destroy their organisation. So certainly our wishes and our solidarity goes to them. And yes, we'll certainly bring you more updates on how it's going for the migrant trade union in South Korea.
And that's the news from around the region. It's 12 minutes past 9 o'clock here on Asia Pacific Currents on Community Radio 3CR.
Don't be too polite, girls, don't be too polite.
Women earn just 82 cents to every dollar earned by men, and the gender pay gap is getting worse. This International Women's Day, take to the streets and demand action on equal pay. Tuesday, 8th of March at 5:30 p.m. outside the State Library, followed by a lively march to a range of city targets. For more info, a copy of our call to action, or to get involved, email freedom.socialist.party@aussiemail.com.au or call 93880062. The Freedom Socialist Party, a 3CR supporter.
Just recognise your value and you won't look back.
3CR programs provide information and analysis you won't hear in the mainstream.
Today we'll be looking at the legacy of the US war on Vietnam on Laos.
And as far as corporate capitalism is concerned, it is the worst political and economic system that you can have.
Our laws about jailing refugees and asylum seekers are so well crafted.
Sex is not irrelevant, and we like who we are, but we don't have to be imprisoned by our gender.
Become a subscriber today. Call us on 9419 8377 or visit 3cr.org.au. 3CR, the voice of dissent.
What are you supposed to do? 3CR.
Community Radio.
855.
I am.
What are you supposed to do? It's just gone 9:15, actually 9:14 here on 3CR Radio, your favourite community radio station. And don't forget that Subscriber Week is coming up. And if you want to support the station and you like what you hear, you have to become a member. This is Asia Pacific Currents, brought to you by Australia Asia Worker Links. Every week, news, stories and events from the labour movement in the Asia Pacific region. And Giselle, those contact details?
If you want to find us on the web, go to www.aawl.org.au. You can email us, aawl@aawl.org.au, and you can phone us on 9663 7277.
And coming up to our star interview for the program for this week, Diana, welcome back.
Thanks so much.
And just for the listeners, you've been in southern China for a few months.
Yeah, that's right. I was in Shenzhen, which is just across the border from Hong Kong, one of the special economic zones that opened up in the 1980s and part of the big manufacturing hub that forms the Pearl River Delta.
Now, before we actually get, I mean, we often talk about the actual struggles of workers and what happens to worker organisations. But if you maybe give us maybe a 30-second, 50-second bit of overview of what Shenzhen is like to live in, because it is one of the very new industrial hubs of China.
Sure. It's, I mean, a remarkable sort of reflection of just how quickly China has urbanised and industrialised over the past 30 years since economic reform started. So in about 1980, Shenzhen would have been a small fishing village, and now it's an enormous metropolis of about 14 million people, a lot of whom are migrants who come and go with the seasons. And it's, I mean, it essentially looks like downtown Hong Kong now, very flashy buildings. It's not that the image of sort of dirty factories that a lot of people would expect. The centre of Shenzhen is service-oriented, a lot of financial services, a lot of trading services, a lot of high-end retail, shiny buildings that really make the Melbourne CBD look like a child's toy. I can see the CBD from my bedroom window here in Melbourne, and occasionally I have to take a second look because I think my eyes are playing tricks on me. It's so small. But Shenzhen is just an absolutely enormous metropolis, and it blends into these other enormous metropoli in the Pearl River Delta, like Guangzhou and Dongguan. And the south of China has just become this enormous manufacturing facility. And when you're there, it really puts China in global context. I mean, there is just such productive capacity there, and it is going on so cheaply. And obviously, a large component of that is the level of wages and the relative lack of adherence to what we would consider to be fair working conditions. And we can talk more about that, obviously, over the next 15 minutes or so.
Actually, there is a word for when cities join up. I think one of them is megalopolis, but there's another word to describe it better as from my geography days. But
that was a long time ago, though, Pierre. I'm surprised you still remember.
Thank you, Diana, for that comment. I do have one more question about Giselle before you go, because, I mean, Dana, you described the central urban area as very shiny, but what about where the workers live? What conditions do they live in?
So one of the characteristics of Chinese workplaces, particularly factories or restaurants, is that they still carry on the old practice from the Maoist days of providing accommodation on site. You know, previously, a workplace would have provided all kinds of welfare, like a cafeteria, like a school, like a medical clinic, and accommodation. And these days, accommodation is still sort of considered as part of a worker's package. So that's obviously one way, or probably the only way, that migrant workers can survive on the low wages they can, and that is because they have free or very cheap dormitory-style accommodation, reminiscent of a horrible school camp, perhaps. Maybe 6 people, 8 people, 10 people sleeping in bunk beds adjacent to the factory. And these factories are increasingly being pushed out of the centre of the city as that's gentrifying and real estate's becoming more expensive. And so the workers who work in factories are living in these incredible suburbs on the outside of the cities, which are basically just designed and just structured, and they just run basically to meet the needs of production. And when you're there, you get the feeling that the human beings who live there, the environment is not designed according to their needs whatsoever. It is just designed to make transport of goods convenient, to make the production of goods most efficient, and you walk around and basic things that make your life bearable, like restaurants or parks or places to spend your free time, are just missing. And that's, I think, very strongly linked to this question of the long working hours in China. If you live in an environment which is so profoundly inhuman, and you've got an eight hour day, 5 days a week, and a double weekend, I mean, what are you going to do? I mean, you can sit by the, you see workers sitting by the side of the road on a small patch of grass on their day off because there's not a lot to do around there except maybe go and get a cheap lunch. And wages are so low that it makes a lot of leisure activities completely impossible. So it's not, I mean, the city is not as slum-like as you might see in some other parts of Asia, but it's just profoundly, like I said before, inhuman and entirely, the architecture is entirely considered from the position of efficient production.
So you were there predominantly to work or study or participate in life in general, I'm guessing. Can you say a little bit more about that? Because one of the it's really difficult to get accurate information about what life and work is like on mainland China. And I just wanted to get a picture of what you were doing for the period that you were there.
So I was enrolled at Shenzhen University doing a language course for those 6 months. And on the side, I was doing I suppose you could call it freelance work with some labour NGOs, most of whom are based in Hong Kong. And if you look at the way international solidarity movements are engaging with China, that's not an atypical situation. I think listeners would be well aware that the union situation is somewhat complicated in China. There's only one official recognised union, and that's a branch of the Communist Party, and any independent unions are illegal in China. And so the limited labour organisation that I could see in the south is largely in the form of community-based NGOs. And we could talk at length about the limitations of those organisations, which don't have a mass base, don't have a high degree of workers' participation, and which are funded externally by foreign organisations. One example would be Oxfam. But there are a lot of unionists who do want to see real workers' organisation grow up in the south of China. And they're not confident that that can be done through the official All China Federation of Trade Unions. And so there are quite a number of progressive unionists from various countries, as I was, sort of hanging around the south of China trying to work out strategic ways to intervene and support workers' organising.
And how do workers respond when the concept or the idea of independently organising is raised? I mean, are they immediately scared or excited? What's the typical reaction?
Well, I will first put in a disclaimer that I didn't meet particularly many workers in that kind of a context, because an obviously foreign person turning up on a strike site is just going to escalate things unnecessarily. But from the people I know and the organisations I know, and also just from analysing the situation, my response to that would be that independent organising seems incredibly intuitive to a lot of workers. There's an incredible number of wildcat strikes going on in China, and they are actually proving very effective in raising wages and improving working conditions. In part, in the area I lived in, that's been assisted by a labour shortage, quite a severe labour shortage, and so workers are very aware that they've got strong bargaining power. And they know people who've done it. Maybe they've even done it themselves before. Just go on a strike at very short notice without any assistance from a formal organisation and have won. And so you might even find yourself meeting a worker and talking about building a union or building an organisation. And some might say, why? Like, we just, you know, one morning someone just pressed the emergency button on the production line and we all walked out. And then the next day we had a 20% wage increase. It was easy. And I suppose the political challenge now is to take that kind of isolated industrial action that's going on all over the country and build it into something that organises workers horizontally and that, you know, creates something that can, you know, bring together all of these workers' grievances and their just mass potential and their productive role in the economy.
Now, one of the issues around China also is, like you said, there's a lot of wildcat strikes, but it's actually been able to not even be involved and intersect with them, but actually hear about them. Mm. And we actually found a news item which we've given you, got in front of you, which actually talks about a wildcat strike in January. I forget now which province, in the southern province.
It was in Guangxi province, which is in the southwest. It's an autonomous province, yep, with a large number of ethnic minorities. And this was a protest over unpaid wages, which happened in early February, and it was reported by the Information Center for Human Rights and Democracy. They said that about 100 construction workers in the city of Wuzhou were heading to the municipal government building to protest, but they were met by riot police who actually opened fire on them, and about 20 people were sent to hospital for treatment, five of those who'd been shot.
So would shooting of demonstrators be a common occurrence, or is this quite an unusual occurrence?
I'm not going to say it's unusual, because it does happen. China's an enormous country with now at least 1.4 billion people. I would say that the response to workers' protests does depend largely on the local government. If you go to a big city like Shenzhen, where there is a relatively open media and there is a lot of public discussion about working conditions, it would be highly unlikely that the government in a big city like that would shoot on protesters. They know the political ramifications. But tucked away in this autonomous region of China in the southwest, and perhaps in an area where the government is otherwise corrupt, or the government is essentially run by a local lord who runs it on a nepotistic basis, who knows? There's a lot of political dynamics which determine how these strikes shape up. But there are an enormous number of strikes that don't end up in violence from the state. For example, I was just watching on mainstream Shenzhen television online yesterday a strike by bus workers. In Shenzhen, every bus line's run by a private company. It's all a
Sounds
bit of a
familiar.
Yeah, all a bit of a chaotic mess, but there's a lot of buses. And a bus company changed hands, and the workers from two lines were completely confused about the wage structure and so basically refused to drive. And the boss of that company, I think, did call the cops, and a scuffle broke out, but soon representatives were chosen from the drivers and they went in and negotiated with the new company. I'm not sure what the outcome was, but my point is that was broadcast on mainstream television. There were journalists down there interviewing bus drivers and ticket sellers. I actually think a Hong Kong NGO was there interviewing people. I think I could sense that. And so in Shenzhen, this kind of thing can happen reasonably openly, provided there is no, I suppose, political content or a direct challenge to the party or the All China Federation of Trade Unions involved in the struggle.
So it really does sound like things are moving forward in the workers' struggle in China. Is that your sense of it, that things are developing and that there is effectively stay tuned, comrades, internationally, we're moving?
Yeah, I'd say it's a very dynamic situation, and I think a lot of works, at least in Shenzhen, are confident about their ability to ask for more from work. And I think that you can see workers' militancy being reflected in government policy. Across the country last year, every city except one, Chongqing, increased the minimum wage, some places more than one time, and that worked out to a national average of a 24% wage increase in 1 year. That is in part a reflection of inflation, so workers may not actually have ended up taking home more, but you can see that workers' militancy is having an effect on government policy. The next challenge is how to convert this spontaneous and very dynamic workers' action into organisation. I suppose that's the topic for next time.
That's right, but I will ask a very quick question. I don't see the Connolly Association outside the door yet. Just very quickly, what's your prediction over the next few months? I know we're in the New Year holiday period still. Over the next few months, how do you see the industrial and political situation in China developing?
I think, like I said just before, inflation and the rising cost of living is going to be the dominant factor, I think, where workers are, I suppose, constantly finding that the wages that they are on are just not enough to make ends meet. Housing is a particularly big problem. I mean, a lot of factory workers wouldn't be contemplating their entire lifetime buying a house in Shenzhen because it's so incredibly expensive. But even just buying a house in the hometown is becoming beyond anybody's reach. And you can see that in so many economies as housing becomes just a commodity for speculation, for profit. This basic human need is becoming beyond the reach of most people, and that makes one's life profoundly insecure. That's going to be a big factor. And I also think... I lost my second point. Probably running out of time anyway.
That's right. Yes, we have run out of time. I'm sure you'll get more chance on APC to tell us about China. So that's fantastic. And
Diana, thank you so much for coming in as our guest on this week's program. And, of course, welcome back to the production team of Asia Pacific Currents. And that is all we have time for on the program today. The Connolly Association is up next. But you can tune in to APC every Saturday morning from 9 o'clock. I'm Giselle Hannah.
I'm Pierre Morrow.
And Diana Beaumont.
And we'll see you next week.